So thank you to those of you who are standing and camping out on the floor in the back. We appreciate you being here. So when we developed this invited session, and it's half contributed, half invited, we really wanted to start with the history, so thank you, Fred, and go into kind of theoretical underpinnings of gender integration and what does that look like in theory. And now we just talked about the federal translation of that into grants, and we're ending with local practice and state practice. And so our final speaker is Forrest Alton, a wonderful colleague in South Carolina. He has been involved in adolescent reproductive health in a variety of capacities, and has served as the chief executive officer of the South Carolina campaign to prevent teen pregnancy for many years. Has a background in public health, but actually has, with his colleagues, been very successful at driving down our state unintended pregnancy rates. And so I think as you've done your programming for us, you've kind of noticed the need for local dialogues with both young boys and girls. And so he's here today to talk to all of you about that.
Okay. Thanks, sir. Good morning. Thanks for sticking with us. So people have been coming in all throughout the morning, which is great. I have to tell you that I tossed and turned a little bit as I was putting these slides together and thought, you know, it's not your traditional APHA presentation. I'm used to seeing a lot more things like Lee presented with, here's some data, and I thought, you know, my slides are a little out there. I don't know if people are ready for it. Then Fred, after I heard you talk this morning, I thought, no, we're good. We're good. Everything's going to be just fine. I appreciate the ability to mix up this conversation a little bit, because I think that as we're talking about including males in this dialogue, there's a little bit of data that's starting to emerge. But what we're also looking for is some thoughtfulness, some creativity, some innovation, some energy around this topic, so that hopefully our data will continue to get better. It's something that is very important, and frankly, we're not talking about enough. I don't have anything to disclose, except for the fact that I should tell you that I'm simply here today, and I'm very blessed to be here today as a storyteller. Most of what I'm going to share with you is the result of the work of our entire organization and team. And as Sarah mentioned, I am the CEO at the South Carolina Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy. Our mission is to improve the health and economic well-being of individuals, communities, and the state of South Carolina by preventing teen pregnancy. And the staff we have assembled is truly one of the best in the business. And I'm going to share with you kind of a compilation and collection of some of the thoughts and ideas that are starting to circulate around our office. And I thought it was probably best to do that rather than to try to pick one project or one study to present the results of. I'm going to put a bunch of that together and tell you a few things that I think are starting to emerge as questions that as a field we need to be asking ourselves. But let's look at an introduction here first. So what you have on the screen here are several things that maybe are commonly cut in half. Pineapples, cakes, oranges, maybe people not so commonly cut in half. But what also is true is that the teen birth rate in South Carolina over the last 20 years has been cut in half, just about 47%. Since the early 1990s. This is, in my slightly biased opinion, one of the greatest public health accomplishments that nobody's talking about. When we were looking at reducing adolescent pregnancy in the early 90s, for anybody to think that we could reduce it 50%, I think they would have laughed you out of the room at that point. But in fact, it's exactly what has happened. And we're also pleased in South Carolina that our numbers are trending with national numbers. The national numbers are right on with these declines in South Carolina as well. In fact, the national campaign just released a statement not too long ago that if you go back to 1990, which is when the teen birth rate in our country peaked, and look at from 1990 to now, the teen birth rate in the United States has decreased 53%, which again is absolutely incredible. However, we still have a long way to go. This is just a quick peek at the 20-year birth rate trends in South Carolina. The red line at the top are 18 and 19-year-olds. The blue line in the middle, 15 to 19, is the age group we're looking at here. And then the orange line at the bottom, 15 to 17-year-olds. We study and look at and analyze and agonize over these data trends, and we actually know a lot about them. We know things by age. We know things by race. It's interesting to note that the teen birth rate in our state and indeed across the country has decreased among all age groups and among all races over the last 20 years. We know a lot of things about the impact of teen birth to teen mothers. We know a lot of data and a lot of information has emerged about the impact of a child being born to a teen mother. We know lots of data about the mom. We don't know quite as much about this graph when you break it out by gender. We just simply don't. We do have pretty solid numbers and pretty solid calculations that tell us 3 out of every 10 teen girls in the United States will get pregnant at least once before her 20th birthday. That's a pretty well-published number. It was actually closer to 5 in 10, 20 years ago, then decreased to 4. Now we're down to about 3 in 10. We have to do some hard estimating, though, however, to get to the number of young men that will get someone pregnant before they turn 20. You see lots of different estimates. The most recent I pulled from the Office of Adolescent Health is 1 out of 10. I've seen this number as low as 1 out of 7. But what's certainly true is it's not 3 in 10, right? So how do we explain this difference? Again, 3 in 10 young women will get pregnant at least once before they turn 20. 1 out of 10 young men will get someone pregnant at least once before they turn 20. I know we've been in the room for a while, and you're fading on me a little bit here, but how do we explain this difference?
Older men.
How else might we explain it? That would be reason number one. Multiple baby mamas. Yes. I had to process that for a second. But yes, we have either older partners or we have teen fathers getting multiple girls pregnant, right? And the answer probably is a little bit of both. So we went diving into some data in South Carolina to take a look at this and try to explain it. And I'll kind of walk you down this pyramid here. We pulled the teen birth data, the actual birth certificate data in South Carolina. This is from 2011. There were 6,024 births to teen moms age 15 to 19. And we said, well, let's go look at these birth certificates and see what we can find out about the dads. Well, first of all, only about half, 54% of the birth certificates in our state had the father identified to begin with. So we've already cut the sample size in half. Then from that, there were about 378 that had identified the father but somehow forgot to indicate the age of the father. So we decreased the sample size even a little bit more. So we got to 2,859 births to teen mothers with an identified father that we knew his age. And of that 2,008, can you hear me okay if I walk away from the microphone? Of that 2,859, only 35% of the fathers were also between 15 and 19. So just let that process for a second, right? I mean, we cut the sample size in half, but only 1,000 of the almost 3,000 we know of birth certificates indicated that there was both a teen mother and a teen father. So the first thing I might suggest to us here as we jump into this conversation is it's important to recognize who we're talking about. Right, and when we're talking about family planning specifically, are we interested in engaging teen boys in this conversation? Or are we interested in engaging the partners of teen girls in this conversation? And in fact, those may be two very different populations. And I think that right off the rip here, we need to acknowledge this and talk about how that factors into our programming moving forward. A couple other questions that I might pose as we go through here. You know, culturally, do we see young men as simply part of the problem here? And again, I'm not putting up a slide like this one to blame men in this conversation. I'm just trying to define the issue. But do we see young men and teen men as part of the problem, or are they part of the solution? Are we encouraging parents to talk to their sons? I have a good colleague who often repeats the quote, if we want to keep our daughters from getting pregnant, we have to start talking to our sons. I couldn't agree more. We've started doing a number of focus groups through several different federal projects and also privately funded projects that we have going on in the state And one of the things that consistently comes up when we're doing focus groups with young men is that if they have had a conversation with their parents about this issue, and that's a stretch if they have had conversations with their parents about this issue, it's most often their mother who's introducing the conversation with them. And as a side note, that's not the preferred strategy for these young men. They would much rather that they were able to talk to somebody of the same gender. And then also a larger question here of, are we framing reproductive health as a women's issue, or are we also acknowledging that young men have reproductive health needs? And the panelists who have spoken already this morning have done a really good job laying out that men do have reproductive health needs. We're going to have to pick up the pace a little bit here. Fred, I'm going to channel some of your energy here and get through some of these slides. I am not going to spend a lot of time here, but I do want to mention the contraceptive piece because it's something that we're challenged with in our office. We're starting to talk about, we haven't quite figured out the solution yet, but check back in New Orleans and we might have something for you. Research is very clear that female use of birth control is increased if her partner is involved in those methods. And that research is at all ages, right? At all levels of the lifespan. We know that female use of birth control is increased. The challenge is that, again, as we continue to talk with and have focus groups and engage boys and young men, they do lack some general information. And certainly, Fred and David, the work that you've been doing for the last 40 years around National Condom Week and such has made a dramatic increase in our nation's education about condoms, but young men still have a lot to learn. There's still a long way to go, and you see some of the quotes. I won't go through and read them all to you. And here's the bigger problem in my mind, is that when we think of young men, we immediately think of their use of condoms. But let's circle back to the front bullet. Research is clear that female use of birth control is increased if her partner is involved in those methods. You know, as a field here, we're seeing a real quick trend, and we're starting to go all in, if you will, on this concept of long-acting reversible contraception. There's lots of talk about LARC and how important it is. And somebody said earlier that we're not talking about your dad's condom anymore. We're not talking about your mother's LARCs here either. We've made fantastic advances in our technology and our ability to offer contraception. The problem is we have separated this conversation entirely. We talk to boys about condoms, we talk to girls about hormonal methods, in this case LARC. We have not yet integrated those conversations. And it's one thing to have them separately, it's another thing to be integrating family planning services together. I also want to talk about school-based sex ed just for a second. I told you I just kind of picked out bits and pieces of different things we're working on. Through the Office of Adolescent Health, we're funded in South Carolina right now working on a randomized controlled trial of a sex education curriculum. It's about 4,000, the cohort's about 4,000 students in 7th and 8th grade across 13 schools in our state, pretty evenly divided male and female. There's a typo somewhere. Those two numbers do not add to 4,145. We also conduct student reaction surveys annually of this curriculum. The cohort's moving through. It started 2 years ago, so the cohort's now in 9th grade, and there is a 12-month follow-up for the curriculum. We are certainly planning on having this data available soon. But one of the things that I thought was interesting is I asked our staff to pull the student reaction surveys, and I wanted to look at them by gender. And what's interesting is that males are more likely to find certain aspects of the curriculum or see them in a negative light. I apologize for putting three graphs on the slide, but I'll just tell you quickly. Overall, I thought the It's Your Game lessons were males more likely to say poor. The role play situations, which is a large part of the curriculum, involves role play. Males were more likely to strongly disagree that those situations were realistic. And another large part of the curriculum is journaling and reflecting and some homework assignments. The journal activities helped me. Males also more likely to strongly disagree. We also then asked students in the curriculum, have you been in a situation, and again, remember, we've been following this cohort now for 2.5 years, have you been in a situation where you think you could have or should have used the lessons you've learned in the curriculum, right? So as you think about your day, could you have used this information? Interestingly enough, males more likely to be in a situation where they say they could have used this information, but less likely to have actually used it. And I think this is kind of interesting to play it out. Again, we're talking about 7th and 8th graders here, and it's a reminder of a couple things, not the least of which is that the narrative we have in our heads of boys pressuring girls to have sex sometimes is flipped, right? Males were actually more likely to be in a situation where they felt they should use the skills from this curriculum, but less likely to do so. Then I thought, well, why are we surprised? Right? Why are we surprised that maybe young men had a negative reaction to sex education in a school-based setting when it seems as though our entire world is struggling with how to reach young men in schools right now? This conversation is not just limited to sex education. But here's the problem for us as we're talking about preventing teen pregnancy. The narrative and the energy and the attention about teen pregnancy prevention efforts in our country have really focused the last decade or so on two locations, clinics and schools. And if we can't figure out how to serve young men in schools, and we can't figure out how to get them into clinics, then we've got a real hard time here trying to figure out how to integrate them into family planning and teen pregnancy prevention services. So just four quick reactions, Sal, if I can. I'm only 5 seconds over so far. The target population, first and foremost, we must clearly define the target population. Is our interest teen boys, or is our interest the population of males that are responsible for teen pregnancy? It's okay if the answer is both, but let's still understand that they are two very distinct populations. As we continue to promote LARC, which I think is a very important strategy for the future of teen pregnancy prevention, as we continue to move on this LARC conversation, we have to include a component that educates young men, not just on their use of condoms, but on the importance of their partner's use of LARC. And that's something that I think deserves some more research and more attention. The classroom instruction that we're doing, the It's Your Game curriculum I showed, does show some promise, right? I mean, it's not that young men hated the material. They were just slightly more likely to not like it than the girls were. We'll have some more results on that very soon, and again, look forward to sharing them with you in New Orleans. But we have to expand the delivery of sex education beyond classroom-based seated learning if we want to be effective reaching young men. And then finally, but certainly not least important, parent engagement remains a critical component of this conversation, no matter what gender we're talking about around reproductive health, and parents remain a really critical important component of our teen pregnancy prevention efforts. So with that, I will wrap up and we'll do some questions. Thank you.
Engaging dialogue. I just realized we have 3 minutes for questioning of this beautiful panel. So maybe we'll exceed just a little bit, but we will have to give time to the 10:30 group to go ahead and get started. So if you'd like to start.
I just have a question before. You mentioned that most of the education that goes on at home is done by mothers. Are there data that boys prefer to talk to their fathers about this?
Yeah, again, that was something that came out in our focus groups, is that they'd rather at least have a male figure, right? Part of the challenge, and certainly the data is skewed a little bit, because a lot of the young men we were talking to maybe didn't have a dad in the home. Right, so I mean, this isn't necessarily a 50-50 conversation, but yes, they were pretty clear with us that they would much prefer to have a trusted male figure. I'm blanking on the word, but gender coherence or something of that nature.
Concordance.
Heather was on the dissertation committee with some of the data I'm referencing. That was an important factor in our conversation.
Is there any data on that anymore? Because we're in the CDC, we're about to revise the National Survey of Family Growth next round, where we ask about if you got sex education on abstinence or birth control, who did you get it from? It's just parents.
Just
they actually
parents
get the prompts asking who that would. I'll take that back. Yeah. That's a great idea.
That would be great.
I was just going to mention that the data that Boris has of the campaign is primarily qualitative currently,
right?
But could be quantitative in the future with the survey should do with you.
I'd like to take a question over here.
Yeah, I was wondering, I know there's a lot of like sort of sexy and awesome websites and apps that are coming up for young women and teen girls. I was wondering if you do have any resources like that, including like Bedsider, for example, for women that are aimed at teen boys or partners of teen girls.
Well, the only one I know of, because we have the Teen Pregnancy Prevention Program at CDC with collaboration with Office of Adolescent Health, is a group called ANSWER,
I don't know if Elizabeth or any of her colleagues are in the room, but it's Sex Etc. is the website,
right.
And Elizabeth Schroeder is ANSWER's CEO, and they have put a lot of time and energy and effort into trying to advance this conversation about young men. I would direct you there as a starting point.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily teenage pregnancy, but of course Men Can Stop Rape has put out a lot of really dynamic materials.
Interesting history. When we did this thing before Ronald Reagan and the Citizens Advisory Committee that started sex education in the schools, we could go into the schools and we could talk about sex education as long as we kept it. In those days, it was called venereal disease. We could not talk about reproductive health. So we went into the schools and we talked about condom use and everything else, and we got around this reproductive health. But that was the milieu, and that was the same problem we had here in Boston when Boston University said the Pope said you had to get rid of all condoms at the Boston University because they were Jesuit school. So if you talk about, at least for us, the older generation, if you talked about sexually transmitted disease, it was okay. But once you hit into reproductive health, then you got into the religious issue. And so we always kept it. We did what we damn well, please excuse the French. We talked about reproductive health, men's responsibility, etc. But we went into the schools with the idea we were going to talk about sexually transmitted disease and venereal disease. in those days.
And maybe one more question?
Well, at one point to add on to David's, I hear Men's Health Network that I also work with hears over and over and over again, people in family planning clinics and various clinic situations are not comfortable working with men. We've heard that in some states they will not allow the nursing staff to do men's education because they're not quote unquote certified doing men's education. So just another plug, Men's Health Network has developed a course program to teach people on community health education for men. So I do think that's a need. I would encourage others to develop such programs because that seems to be a real or perceived barrier. The first way to overcome it is to challenge it and address it. So if you're interested on how to convince yourself that you should be on that program, I encourage you to think about how do you do that. How do you get past that barrier?
Okay, so I'll take one more question. It's 10:03. So does anybody have? Okay.
It wasn't really a question, but it was more of a comment around the kind of ruining the mood. So in the work that we've tried to do, where I'm from, is really to talk about sex and about what's the rush, what's the rush in penetration, right? And to try to see it was really to try to teach males to be better lovers, really. And then that's all part of that, idea that men who are real men, take time and don't have to push or rush so that the condom becomes part of sex play and the foreplay. So I would agree that talking about sex is sort of a better way of getting at it than just exploring the condom. But it depends on how much time you have as well, right, or where you are.
I had a question just about the condoms and what efforts you guys have towards promoting condoms among gay men and what type of media advertisements you have.
Yeah, we did it. In San Francisco, we have the AIDS Walk, and we raised $6,000 last year. And we gave out 100,000 of these Captain Condom T-shirts at the AIDS Walk. On the backside, this was the 40th anniversary of Woodstock. We had 175,000 people. It was the largest giveaway of condoms, 100,000 condoms that we gave away free of charge. And it was all during the AIDS Walk with the T-shirts. We gave out 10,000 T-shirts. So what I'm suggesting here next year, thank you, very quickly, is stretch your legs for condoms. We have a fun run. Everything's got to be fun next year when we start this campaign at APHA. And then we get the Xavier School of Pharmacy and all the medical schools, and we do some exciting stuff here to get your, get the movement going versus sitting around. And again, I love talking about epidemiology. I learned at school, and I don't understand what the hell any of you people said. But I do understand giving away T-shirts, giving away condoms, talking about it, getting groups lined up like on the AIDS Walk. They had all these people dressed up like condoms, and et cetera, et cetera. You need some excitement. I'm old. I'm 80 years of age. But you need to do something more than talk to each other. And again, I'm just a simple pharmacist, but we're the most available, accessible, and acceptable of all healthcare people. Start talking to pharmacists. You don't see pharmacists coming to this meeting. So I invited Sal to come down to the American Pharmacy Association annual meeting in Florida. Start inviting people into your groups that are pharmacists, other kind of people, instead of, he's, no.
On that note, thank you. And I just want to very briefly say he's so humbly not saying that he started the first AIDS Walk in San Francisco. So thank you for doing that so many years ago.